Division One of the Court of Appeals. As you know, we don't normally sit on Thursdays, so we're glad that you're all present, and we're glad to be here as well. We have two cases scheduled at 9 o'clock, and I'd like to call and make sure the lawyers are here, and then I'll review our procedures briefly. We have the Marathon Oil Company against Arkansas Oklahoma Gas Corporation. Are counsel here for that case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll hear argument first in that case, and then after that we have Gomez versus the Industrial Plant Appeals Office. Are counsel here for that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we'll hear argument next in that case. As you know, we have 15 minutes for each side for oral argument. We have both a digital timer and our traditional color-coded timer that starts green and turns amber when you have 5 minutes left and turns red when your time is up. If you're representing the appellant, you can reserve time for your rebuttal oral argument. If you'd like to me to indicate when a certain amount of time is left, I'd be happy to do that, but you can determine that for yourself as well through the digital timer. You should know that all the judges have read the briefs, and at least one of us has had an opportunity to review the record, so you may wish to focus your arguments on the legal issues rather than the facts, but of course how you present your argument is up to you. You should be aware that there's a toggle switch on the podium that you can use to raise and lower it at your convenience. You should also be aware that we're recording the oral arguments and they're posted on the internet, so if you have any confidential or private information, you may be careful about how you phrase that. And finally, this is the first of two finalies. Finally, if you have a cell phone, please make sure it's turned off so that it doesn't inadvertently interrupt us during oral argument. And my second finally is that we're pleased to be joined this morning by Senior Judge John Criswell. So with that having been said, we're now ready to hear the oral argument in Marathon Oil versus Arkansas Oklahoma Gas Corporation.
May it please the court, I'm John Shepherd, representing Marathon, the successor to TXO in this case. The question for the court here is, does TXO have to indemnify AOG for AOG's cost to defend allegations of its own misconduct? And the answer is no, for two reasons. First, on the measurement claim that Greinberg asserted against AOG, Greinberg alleged that AOG deliberately mismeasured the gas. And the law is clear, there's no indemnity for intentional conduct. Second, for both of Greinberg's claims, the measurement claim and the non-payment claim, a proper reading of the contract here is that there is no indemnity for AOG's own conduct. And what Greinberg alleged was that AOG engaged in the conduct. There were no allegations about anything that TXO did or did not do. Let me first address the measurement claim. And what AOG tries to do in its brief is obscure what Greinberg's claim really was. And they keep calling the claim a negligence claim. That's not what Greinberg alleged. Greinberg clearly alleged that AOG engaged in willful and wanton misconduct. Two of the claims were for civil theft and conversion, clearly intentional torts. And the other claims incorporated the allegation of willful and wanton conduct and sought punitive damages. You can't get punitive damages unless you show intentional wrongful conduct. So the law is clear that there's no indemnity for this kind of allegation by Greinberg, and AOG does not dispute that. In fact, what AOG says is that TXO did not raise this issue below. We point out in our reply brief, we quote from the briefs below, the summary judgment briefs where TXO raised this issue below. And that's at pages 4 and 5 of our reply brief. Let me turn to the second reason why we should prevail in this appeal. And that is, even if the measurement claim is not based on intentional misconduct, there's still no indemnity. Just last year, this court in the Boulder Plaza case made clear that for one party to assume to indemnify another party for his misconduct, whether negligence or anything else, there has to be clear and unequivocal language in the contract. This contract does not have that kind of language. There are two provisions at issue here. There is Section 6 in the contract called royalties, and in that section, TXO agreed to pay the royalties and to pay them properly. And if they failed to pay them properly, they would be responsible. But Greinberg never claimed that TXO improperly paid royalties. That wasn't the claim at all. On the mismeasurement claim, the allegation was that AOG didn't measure all the gas that that TXO delivered to it, didn't pay for all the gas, and therefore AOG shorted everybody, including TXO.
Mr. Shepherd, is there any language in either paragraph 6 or section K of the contract that limits the scope of the indemnity clause to mismeasurement?
In the there's language in the contract that shows that mismeasurement is not part of the indemnity. And if you look at paragraph K of the contract, I think that's the best place to start. In that paragraph, it's a long paragraph, but there TXO agrees to deliver the gas to AOG at the inlet to AOG's meter free of any adverse claims. The indemnity that follows says that TXO will indemnify AOG for any claims made to or against that production. In the context of paragraph K, what that means is that TXO is going to deliver the gas to the meter free of any adverse claims, for example, a title claim to the gas. But the contract makes clear that once the gas goes into AOG's meter, it is AOG's sole responsibility. The contract says, in fact, that TXO has no role in measurement. It's AOG's responsibility entirely. So if you look at paragraph K and that language to or against said production, it's clear that what the parties are talking about is TXO is going to deliver the gas to the inlet of the meter. It will indemnify AOG for any adverse claims made up to that point. But after that point, it is AOG's sole responsibility. And under the Boulder Plaza case and the Supreme Court's decision in public service, for TXO to have assumed the obligation to indemnify AOG for allegations of AOG's own mismeasurement, this contract had to say that clearly, and it did not do that.
Well, go ahead.
You're saying that a broad indemnification clause is not sufficient under those cases, that it has to make specific reference to misconduct indemnity?
I think in the public service company case, the court made clear that the contract doesn't have to use magic words like negligence. But you can have a broad indemnity that still doesn't cover the conduct of the other party. I would agree that this is a broad indemnity insofar as it relates to TXO's own duties under the contract. But it can't be extended to AOG's own duties under the contract.
What about Judge Meyer's interpretation of the these paragraphs as determining an allocation of risk between the two parties, and that he according to Judge Meyer's interpretation, this showed a conscious decision on the part of TXO to accept responsibility for any claims that might arise, even ones against AOG?
I think where the district court erred and accepted AOG's argument is in reading that language in paragraph K, where it says to or against said production. If you read the district court's decision, the court translates that into relating to the production. And the court viewed a claim involving mismeasurement of gas by AOG as relating to the production because, of course, measurement relates in some way to the gas that is produced. But that changes the wording of the contract. The contract says that TXO will indemnify for claims made to or against the production, which when read in the context of paragraph K means title claims, liens, adverse claims to ownership of the gas, and doesn't apply to the gas after it goes through AOG's meter.
Isn't that the central issue here, the meaning of that phrase? and whether or not these claims fall within the meaning of that phrase?
I think that is the central issue here, Your Honor.
And you're saying that claims against production are in effect, in a very general, generic, and therefore mistaken view or interpretation, would be a claim against title to production, or a claim such as a lien or other interest in production. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement, and that's a fair summary of paragraph K, Your Honor. Let me give an example. And we said that this first example in our brief, that if AOG's right on what this contract means, that we have to indemnify for anything really essentially to do with this gas, then if TXO sued AOG for mismeasurement of gas, there'd be an indemnity for that too. We couldn't sue AOG for their own mismeasurement of the gas.
Now, the Grenberg's gets sued here on the basis that their interest was not being fully paid. Now, does it make any difference whose responsibility it is? Is that not a claim against production?
It was not in this case, Your Honor, and here's why. For 13 years, the parties had been producing the gas from this well, and Grenberg had an interest in the lands covered by this well. For 13 years, Grenberg's gas was produced in the well, AOG bought the gas and paid for it. There was no question whatsoever that Grenberg owned a 30% interest in this gas. So there's no adverse claim by Grenberg. What happened in 1999, after 3 years of paying Grenberg directly, and after being instructed by the operator to continue doing so, AOG decided on its own, without telling anybody, not to pay Grenberg or not even to pay the operator for that gas. So they took all the gas and didn't pay for 30% of it. It can't be surprising that in the face of that, Grenberg would bring a lawsuit seeking to be paid for his share of the gas. Anybody in this courtroom would have done that. So this was not, Grenberg's claim to be paid for the gas by anybody was not an adverse claim to the gas. AOG wasn't paying for all the gas they took. They paid for 70% of the gas they took. So again, there was no, AOG says there was an internal dispute among the interest owners in this well, and that's what the indemnity covers. There was no internal dispute.
Mr. Shepard, I'd like to turn your attention for a second to paragraph 6. That doesn't use the phrase to or against production, and it seems to have very broad language that refers to payments and settlements of whatsoever kind and nature due in respect of production delivered here under. In your view, why doesn't that section apply?
It doesn't apply for a couple of reasons. First, talking about this non-payment claim when AOG stopped paying for the gas. How can the operator pay Grenberg money or royalty if the buyer of the gas, AOG, is not paying for the gas? In 1999, when this happened, the operator's understanding was that AOG was paying directly to Grenberg for 30% of the gas. They just stopped doing that, and the operator didn't even know. They didn't tell the operator what they were doing. They just stopped paying anybody for that gas. What Section 6 refers to is that AOG is going to pay for all of the gas, which it didn't do, and then out of the proceeds that the operator receives, they're going to pay the share to other parties like Grenberg. And that didn't happen here because AOG didn't pay for the gas.
But as I read Judge Meyer's opinion, he said TXO knew that it had to pay everybody for the gas, including the Grenbergs. Is that correct?
AOG knew they had to pay for the gas. They just stopped doing it.
No, I misunderstood your question. Perhaps I wasn't clear in my question. My reading of Judge Meyer's opinion is that under the indemnity clause, there was a shift of the allocation of risk because TXO assumed the responsibility for paying everybody who had an interest in the well.
I don't think there was a shift in responsibility because what is typically the case, actually, is that the producer of the gas and the lessor of, or the lessee of leases pays the royalties to those who have an interest. And the buyer in this case, AOG, pays the producer, the operator of the gas. And that's what was happening here. From 1986 until 1994, AOG paid for all the gas they took, and they paid it to the operator, and the operator distributed the proceeds, including to Greinberg. The only problem arose when AOG stopped paying anybody for Greinberg's share of the gas. That can't be the kind of claim that TXO was agreeing to indemnify for when AOG doesn't pay anybody for the gas. This was not a situation of TXO's making. It was AOG's own decision to stop paying anybody for the gas in response to a QI-TAM lawsuit that Greinberg had filed that had nothing to do with TXO. If I could save the remainder of my time for rebuttal, I'd like to do that, unless the court has further questions at this time.
That's fine. You have about 2 minutes left, Mr.
Okay,
Shepard.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Kim Bruch. I'm here on behalf of Arkansas Oklahoma Gas Corporation. I do want to address a few of the points that have come up related to the indemnification. And then hopefully with a few minutes remaining, I would like to address a couple of the jurisdictional arguments. A couple of the issues that have come up relate to the scope of the indemnity, which I think everyone pretty much agrees is the heart of the district court's order and the heart of the appeal. The district court really took the case law, which is appropriate under Colorado, which agreeably does not require any magic words such as negligence to be in there. It merely suggests that you have to look at the scope of the indemnification and make sure it's sufficiently broad to reflect the intent of the parties, which I think is the key in most of the cases. Here, Judge Myers was able to review the contract, which also includes the terms and conditions, which contain the two paragraphs that are at issue here, Section 6 and Section K. And in doing so, he agreed that the language of the indemnification clause is broad enough to cover all of the claims that were at issue in this case, including any claims which he phrased as that would include a breach of AOG's obligations under the contract.
Intentional?
I think intentional under Colorado law is not covered. The distinction here is that intentional may have been pled, but I don't think it was pled in the narrow scope that TXO suggests it was. The complaint that Mr. Greinberg filed contained claims that alleged two things. They alleged the non-payment of anything coming to him because AOG was holding that portion of the production, which is entitled to do under Section K of the contract.
Which was intentional,
depending how you phrase that. I mean, it was a permitted act under the contract, which would not be a willful misconduct the way that they want to phrase it. It's a permitted action under the contract. And then he alleged underpayment. Now, mismeasurement may be a portion of that, but ultimately, it's irrelevant. The underpayment really was much broader in scope than that because he was alleging much more than just a mismeasurement claim. That's just the way that it's been defined.
Was he alleging anything that the TXO had done?
I don't believe there was any allegations against TXO that were asserted.
So all of the claims are based upon either negligent or intentional acts person receiving the buyer here.
Or a better way to phrase it, I think, is potentially a breach of the obligations of AOG under the contract, which doesn't necessarily mean it was intentional or negligent. It's just a determination of whether it's proper under the contract or not. Now, I think ultimately what happens here is, despite it being pled as intentional or not, it becomes irrelevant. Because there, as Judge Myers pointed out, regardless of which provision of the contract you look at or whether it's intentional or not, there was never any evidence submitted nor any finding that AOG committed any intentional wrongdoing.
But what difference does that make? We're talking about an indemnification for defense costs. And don't you base the indemnification or right thereto upon the allegation? I mean, if you'd been successful in trying this case and winning, or if you'd been unsuccessful and lost, it would have made no difference, would it?
I think it would make a difference, and there is one case which we have cited, which
you're saying that had you lost, there would have been no indemnity?
It depends on the determination of the order when we lost. If there was a finding of some sort of intentional conduct, the indemnity could have been limited by that finding. If there was one claim of intentional conduct, it necessarily wouldn't negate the entire indemnity provision either. If there were several claims that did not involve a finding of intentional conduct, those still could have been found to be valid indemnity obligations. And in the Equitex v. Unger case, it was kind of a similar situation. The court there deferred a ruling on indemnity until a jury verdict came back. So they did wait. And in that particular case, the jury found some willful and intentional conduct, and the judge said, well, as a result, you can't have indemnity under Colorado law. But it was based upon the ultimate result. And here, Judge Myers noted that all of the claims had already been dismissed based on res judicata grounds. You didn't even have to get to the underlying facts of the claims because legally they were insufficient, because the Oklahoma court had already determined that Greinberg had no right to receive payment directly from AOG. As a result, you don't examine how much he was supposed to get or how he was supposed to get it. He had no right in the first place to allege any of these claims. Therefore, there could be no intentional misconduct by AOG.
The basis for his claim that the Oklahoma court ruled upon, I gather, was a claim of implied contract between Greinberg and your client.
That is correct. Yes, and because the Oklahoma court issued a declaratory judgment specifically finding that Greinberg had no right to receive payment directly from AOG, then that undermined every claim that he had, regardless of whether it alleged intentional conduct or not. You never even got that far because the claims were legally insufficient. So no examination of that was ever even necessary.
And I gather a predicate to the liability on the Greinberg claims would have been a finding of implied contract or some other obligation to pay, which did not exist.
Yes, I believe that would be true. And that's essentially.
And you say that a claim by him against your client, that your client had entered into an implied contract with him, is a claim against production?
It is an adverse claim against payment or production. Section 6 covers indemnity on payments. Section K covers indemnity with respect to production, and we would suggest that production is a broad term referring to the general contract between TXO and AOG. That's essentially the business deal that's going on here. AOG is agreeing to purchase 100% of the production from the well, which encompasses payment issues and everything that goes along with that, maintenance of the well. Production really relates to the well itself and to the entire transaction between AOG and TXO.
What is your response then to Mr. Shepard's argument that based upon part of the language in Section K that the obligation of TXO ended at the meter that once AOG obtained the gas?
The contract really covers that, and I think that's part of the reason why it is properly interpreted to be broad. TXO suggests that it has no role in measurement, which I think is maybe not entirely accurate, depending on how you look at that, because what the contract does, because I think of the indemnity, is it provides TXO with lots of checks and balances because of that obligation to ensure that things are being handled properly, even in terms of measurement. The terms and conditions section G of the contract, or section A, subparagraph G, permits TXO to have a check meter installed, permits TXO to demand audits of the measurement records, permits TXO to demand testing and have a representative available for that and present. So there's any number of things TXO can do proactively to ensure that its indemnity obligation would never come up because it's properly protecting the lessees of its well, the people that it has a contractual relationship with, that it sells the gas on behalf of. And that's part of the whole reason of the indemnity. AOG has no relationship to any of the people that TXO has that contractual relationship to. We don't know who they are. We don't know what percentages they own in the well. That's all TXO's obligation to them. And they warrant that to us when we agree to buy the gas from the well. So there's plenty of checks and balances available in there. And in fact, there's even a provision in the contract that provides that after 12 months, the measurements are deemed to be accurate and the records related to them can be destroyed. So if one of the lessees of the well has an issue with respect to measurement, the proper procedure is to go to TXO, who then has a contractual relationship with AOG and has all the checks, remedies, and rights to deal with that way, rather than the way Mr. Greinberg did it.
I have another question. What is your response to Mr. Shepard's question that the indemnification clause can't possibly have been intended to apply to the situation that occurred here when AOG just stopped making payments to either the Greinbergs or TXO for a period of 3 years and then goes after TXO for indemnification? That doesn't seem reasonable.
Well,
according to Mr. Shepard,
I think the issue is how you define the adverse claim. And TXO's position is that there was no adverse claim based on AOG withholding the funds. In fact, that's not the case. The inherent conflict that occurs is AOG has a contractual responsibility to pay 100% of the proceeds to TXO, who then pays it to their lessees. And that's the only way it really works, because as the operator of the well, they're going to take fees and maintenance and stuff out of that money. We have no relationship with those people. So for one of the lessees to then come and demand payment directly from AOG creates a problem, because if AOG pays it to the lessee, we're breaching the contract with TXO. So you have a true potential double liability situation, which is exactly what the Oklahoma court found in the interpleader. The interpleader case that was filed down there, the Oklahoma court found that was proper, interpled the funds. The then operator of the well did appear and participate in that proceeding, Stigler, and the Oklahoma court found to do a proper interpleader, you have to show that adverse claim, and it was there, and that's been litigated and resolved in Oklahoma. So I think there is an adverse claim there.
So in that interpleader action in Oklahoma, did AOG deposit into the court all of the payments for that three-year period?
Yes, Your Honor. And if I can turn briefly to the jurisdictional issues that came up, there is one issue that I want to bring to the attention of the court, only because it appeared really in the reply brief, and I want to make sure that the court takes a close look at the decisions that are at issue there. In the reply brief, TXO suggests that the Farrow case that they cite is a better law than the Baldwin case that we cited with respect to the issue of whether an appeal is ripe, depending on whether you have already gotten a determination on the amount of attorney's fees to be awarded. In reviewing those cases, I do think that Baldwin requires a closer reading by the court. I think that the Farrell case, for some reason, the Farrell case cites to Baldwin. It doesn't contain any discussion or analysis of Baldwin, and I think it perhaps misconstrues what the ultimate intent of Baldwin is. And ultimately, Baldwin is still the precedent here. The Farrell case did not overrule it, and Baldwin clearly suggests that the court was trying to make a bright line rule so that no analysis had to be conducted regarding whether attorney's fees are part of the costs or part of the damages. And the Baldwin court said, we don't want you to do a case-by-case analysis. An order is final and ripe for appeal, regardless of whether there has been a determination of the amount of attorney's fees to be awarded.
But didn't Farrell, whether it said so or not, change that rule? The Farrell is a Supreme Court case, a later Supreme Court case than Baldwin, and doesn't it draw a distinction between attorney fees that are due as a result of the litigation that you're talking about, and attorney fees that are considered not as attorney's fees, but as damages?
It cites to Baldwin, suggesting that Baldwin stands for that proposition.
Suppose they're wrong. They're the Supreme Court, aren't they?
Well, they are, but Baldwin still stands. I mean, I think the fact that they may have cited back to Baldwin, there's obviously a tension there, but Baldwin is still the precedent. And
well,
there's a specific...
the latest. So don't we follow Farrell in case of any conflict?
I don't think necessarily that you do, because Baldwin still stands. And Farrell really was just a citation back suggesting that that's what Baldwin stands for. And there's a specific quote out of Baldwin that doesn't make any sense if the Farrell court really was suggesting that that's what it stands for. I mean, Farrell specifically said in a quote that such a rule will permit litigants to comply with the relevant appellate rules without a case-by-case analysis of the relationship of attorney's fees to the relief sought and will avoid uncertainty. That doesn't mean anything if the Farrell court is correct in the way that it cites Baldwin. And it may perhaps be something that the Colorado Supreme Court is going to ultimately have to correct, but I think that there is a disparity between what Baldwin really says and what it's currently being cited for.
By the Supreme Court.
By the Supreme Court. And then finally, obviously, we've opined an argument that I think is one of first impression for the court, because in this case, even if you don't want to deal with Baldwin, in this case, the issue of attorney's fees was removed from the jurisdiction of the district court because the parties agreed to arbitrate it. And our suggestion is that by doing that, that does not toll the appeal deadline for 5 years until you get a determination on that issue. And I think that's contrary to the ADR statutes. Thank you.
That the court found that Greinberg had no legal right to be paid directly by AOG does not answer the indemnity question. For the indemnity question, we have to look at the contract and see what is the scope of what TXO agreed to indemnify for. That AOG had a successful defense to the allegations doesn't resolve indemnity because, as you noted, Your Honor, the question is, what is the scope of the clause and are these defense costs covered? And here, they were not. We have intentional conduct being alleged, and we have conduct being alleged that occurs after TXO has delivered the gas to AOG.
Are you going to address the jurisdictional issue?
Yes, Your Honor, I can do that. First, on the attorney's fees part of it, the law is clear in Colorado that there's a distinction between attorney's fees as costs awarded for this litigation or attorney's fees as damages.
Is that the issue that's involved here? Isn't the question whether or not the trial court had in effect entered a final judgment because it had no jurisdiction over the attorney fee award?
Well, here, of course, there was no final judgment entered at that point, but...
Well, what I'm saying is, why wasn't there?
Because the parties didn't think there was a final judgment. They were going to the arbitrator to have damages decided.
Then I understand
they
that.
They went back to the court for the final judgment.
The court no longer had any jurisdiction over the attorney fee issue, doesn't it?
It no longer had any jurisdiction except as review under the Arbitration Act, which the parties went back to the court.
What had there been no petition to confirm? There's
no requirement for
a petition to confirm, is there?
No, I think here the answer to that question is this. Just as in the case with an award by a court of liability without damages and a party can't appeal that, I think that applies here as well for the same rationale because...
What if there'd never been a petition to confirm?
Then there wouldn't have been a final judgment.
So there'd never be a final judgment?
If there was no petition to confirm, I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, but the answer to the question about did the court have jurisdiction, should an appeal have been filed 3 or 4 years ago, the answer is no, because damages had not been decided. The arbitrator could have awarded no damages, and that is part of the reasoning for not allowing an appeal until both liability and damages have been decided. It's part of the matter of conserving judicial resources. So here there was no need to appeal until after the arbitration award determining damages.
Mr. Shepherd, your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Thank you, Ms. Bruch. We appreciate both of your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. Council may now set up for the Gomez case and we'll hear arguments next on that case.